Hello and welcome to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. It's the podcast where I sit down with an extraordinary person and share their story. They might have overcome some kind of adversity or they might still be on their journey, but the stories that will make you laugh, cry, and hopefully feel a little bit inspired. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by an amazing individual who's not let anything get in the way of building the life he truly wants. Jack Ivins Gardner works as part of the production team on ITV Daytime at the prestigious ITV Studios, which is actually how we met. So I'm so glad he's finally joining me on the podcast today. Jack has a wonderful husband, Wes, and they are in the process of adopting a child together, making their fantastic podcast, Two Dads Can Do It, along the way. Jack also has an invisible disability of autism. I'm so excited to talk to Jack today about all aspects of his story and his many admirable qualities.
Thank you, Jack, for joining me.
Well, thank you, Katie, for having me. It's an absolute privilege. Thank you so much.
So I'm really glad we finally got together to do this.
Me too.
Because obviously we work together in real
Absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely.
Well, for people that don't understand, you know, how would we work together? What would we do? You know, particularly when I used to come on as a guest, Jack would be the person that would brief me. He would give me all the research. He would make sure that I had everything I needed to go on telly and come across in the way that the public see you come across. So it's people like Jack behind you that actually help you get to that point on screen. So it's funny because I actually only know a small part about your story myself. And you know, if I'm sort of thinking, well, how did we first meet, and you know, what did I first know about you? And we first met in the days where you could wear whatever color you wanted to wear.
I miss those days,
because now they make you wear all black, don't they?
Unfortunately, yes. Yes, I do look a bit like a funeral director. It is unfortunate, the code of the studio crew, we cannot wear anything reflective. So it has to be any colour you want as long as it's black, which is slightly painful for my sartorial needs. It makes my clothing bill a lot cheaper, but I do miss my colours, definitely.
Because that is how I remember you. So it was before I was a panellist on Lose So Many. It was when I'd come into ITV as a guest if I was promoting a book or a TV show. And I always remembered you as you had the best kind of flamboyant wardrobe. You'd have bright colours, patterns. Like, you never, ever kind of went under the radar.
No, not good for guests who may have had a hangover. I think they sort of saw me from a distance and started putting on sunglasses. But it made me happy at that time of morning.
So that's how I'd remember you, bright shirt guy. And then I started working on Lose So Many as a panellist. And then we both took part in a campaign for ITV, which I should let you talk about that. Talk about the campaign.
So it was a campaign focusing on invisible disability. It was sort of made up of two halves. It was a public advertising campaign, which you were an excellent face for. And it was talking about the various disabilities that you face that people may not have known about you, that has all flown under the radar. But alongside that, ITV launched on their website a subsection which focused on ITV colleagues who themselves had hidden disabilities. As a autistic person, I did a short video where I talked about sort of day-to-day life and working with autism and working at ITV. There was a nationwide campaign with Your Good Self, and it sort of took from there, really.
And I have to say, until I saw that content and you doing that, I didn't know that you were autistic. So were you asked to do this? Was it your suggestion?
So I have been part of ITV's ABLE network. This is a group set up by ITV colleagues who themselves have a disability. It gives us a chance to meet each other, discuss ITV's disability policies, making sure that we feel that the company is catering to everyone's needs and has been as inclusive as it can be. So they, off the back of several discussions, we had monthly meetings, and this has been in the pipeline for a while. they emailed all of us to say that would anyone be interested in doing a short video about talking about their own invisible disability. And I thought, oh, I would like to be part of that because I'm sort of quite a big, you know, I'm always very much about it's the more voices and more faces people see that are disabled, the more normalizing it could be. So it was something I was very keen on doing, and I'm very glad I did it.
Yeah, and I suppose it's not something to take lightly. It's a big decision, isn't it? It's giving away some of your privacy and anonymity.
Definitely. And that was something, I think, even today, although things are slowly getting better, there is still very much a stigma attached of being disabled in all walks of life. But I think particularly there is that real fear of being disabled in the workplace and that feeling of being judged to be inferior to able-bodied, able-minded colleagues, that you are not able to talk about it with your colleagues, not ask for support or additional time or additional resources.
Well, this is the interesting thing for me because you are in a very responsible role. You know, you have a very successful, yes. You have a successful career. You have an aspirational career for many people.
Yeah.
And I'd love to know about your journey because it's nerve-wracking to work in telly, whoever you are.
I was always interested in television, the workings of it. The very first time I was ever in a television studio was when I was 10, when my school was chosen to be on the Chuckle Brothers game show To Me To You. For those of you who grew up in the 90s, you may well remember it. And I was in the audience, two of my school colleagues, they were picked to be teammates. And I still remember, it was a studio in Wembley, and I still remember walking in and just being utterly amazed at, because you, when you're watching television as a child, you have no concept of how television works, what goes into making it. And all I could just remember, just the atmosphere, and even like something as mundane as the lighting grid, this enormous grid above us with all these lights down and all these cameras. All I was doing was craning my neck up, so much so that I didn't actually realise I'd walked into the studio. I immediately tripped over a camera cable and crashed into a camera operator. That was my introduction to television. And after that, I was pretty much, this is something I wanted to do. I had no idea how I was going to do it. And because I was kind of young enough and naive enough, I kind of didn't really think about how difficult or tough it was to be in that industry. And it wasn't something that was really discussed. I spent most of my education in special needs schools, which was great in terms of holistically, but in terms of education, it is more of a holistic approach. It's not as challenging as perhaps a mainstream environment. There's less facilities because it's much smaller. But I was still determined. I wanted to do all the things that I wanted to go to college. I wanted to go to university because it just felt that's what you had to do. I'm very keen on having a sort of structure in my life. And I just wanted, I had a sort of tick box. But I was very fortunate when I was at university that I was invited to 2 weeks work experience at GMTV, as it then was. Now it's, of course, Good Morning Britain. There was something different about that environment, and I just felt this is somewhere that I feel safe, and that is something that I think a lot of autistic people strive for in all facets of their life. They want that sense of security and safety, and I was very fortunate that I found that so early on in my career. And from there, I graduated from university, and then I was called in just for a chat. There was no context as why they wanted to chat with me. So I just rocked up. It was very informal. And then at the end of it, they said, we've got an emergency opening because one of the runners has just jacked in their job. Would you mind working for 3 months? And that was 13 years ago. I've not really left since. Whether or not people want me to leave, I'm not sure. But I've 3 months has turned into a very long 3 months.
It's so interesting hearing about your journey because you've basically been in telly all your career. And I'm thinking, mm-hmm. like, you know, me and you are recording this podcast, it's October 2021, yeah. but you're talking about a long time ago when you started this
yes. career,
when actually, let's face it, it wasn't, you know, now we can identify as disabled, talk about it quite proudly. Yes, yes you may get trolled, but that's sort of a lot less than it was than the years ago you're talking about.
Absolutely.
And actually, especially, you know, neurodiverse conditions like autism or Asperger's didn't even have a name at one point.
No.
That people were literally bullied and seen as outsiders, and only physical,
completely.
You know, it was only physical disability that we learned about at school, that people understood. Mm-hmm. And so going back to that first sort of few steps of getting work experience and starting, would you mention your disability in your CV? Would you talk about it in an interview? Because you would be up against people, other candidates that presumably didn't have autism.
I did ask close friends and people who were working, and I did ask the question, should I disclose the fact that I'm autistic? And majority were like, well, no, you can kind of mask that, you can cover that, you don't really, when people meet you, they don't see you as disabled. I like to say now, if I was 19, 20, 21 now, I would have no issues whatsoever. There is more, employers are definitely doing more to encourage people with disabilities to disclose upon application, and very much it is stated, disclosing a disability will not impede your application in any shape or form. But there is still that concern of stigma being attached. There is still that concern of being disabled. If I ask for more time, more resources, or more support when I'm employed, will an employer think, you know what, why should we bother when we have a person who doesn't require these things? They could be employed, and it'd be a far easier and less maybe cost-effective way of employment. But there's still work to be done. I think that's the way I'd look at it.
Yeah, you touched earlier on diagnosis. And when I was researching you, I saw you actually got your diagnosis so young, at 3 years old. And I had,
yeah.
I mean, I've got so many questions around that, because I've got people in my life that are going through diagnosis of autism. And the one thing I've started to learn is it's very difficult to diagnose at a young age.
Yes, it is. It is. I think what was interesting about the time when I was diagnosed was it just came off the back of the release of the film Rain Man. So autism awareness at that point was at an all-time high. Even though looking today, the film is quite flawed in terms of its depiction of autism, it at least brought autism to the fore as a condition to talk about. So doctors, medical professionals had more understanding and more information at their disposal than they ever had before. And I think that, for one, at least really helped me.
And what about, you know, you talked about not going to a mainstream school, but despite that,
yeah.
you were very ambitious and you did go
yeah.
to uni. I wondered what life was like outside of academia. What was your social life like growing up?
I could not go to a place that wasn't my home or my school without someone taking me, being with me. So my mum was practically, aside from being my mother, she was pretty much my carer. It's almost as close as one can feel to almost being agoraphobic without being agoraphobic. I spent most of my time at home or on a bus, going to school and then coming back. And that was pretty much my life up until the age of about 15 or 16. So I ended up going to a child therapist, and I spent a lot of time sort of learning coping mechanisms to deal with anxiety, and I was able for the very first time to walk down the road by myself at the age of 16. I was very fortunate with my childhood in the way that my mum never tried to box me into what she felt a mainstream child should be like. She never said, oh, you need to be doing this, Jack. You should be going out and seeing friends. You should be doing this. She knew what I wanted. She knew what made me happy. And that was very much at the forefront of my mind. My mum was an incredible advocate for me. And yeah, I know I would not be where I was out of. So if she's listening, thank you, Mum. Yeah, I think that was where I was incredibly lucky. It is very much about being led by your child and what makes them happy.
That's really interesting because I'm imagining other people will be listening who are parents and carers and friends of people either, you know, diagnosed or getting diagnosed with autism. And actually, it's not about encouraging the child. It's about being child-led, you say.
If any parent asks me what they could do for their autistic child, it is so much about being the advocate, being the support they need. At the end of the day, I find the more you invest in your child, your autistic child, the more you will get out of them. I always look at it as putting a round peg in a square hole, and your child is that round peg. Sometimes in life, they just won't fit in to the box you want to put them in. It's better to keep them out of the box, be happy for who they are, and celebrate them.
Oh, that's like a quote, isn't it? That's so true. It's almost like letting go, isn't it? And quite liberating, and that sense of actually what is, you know, and not trying to shoehorn something that isn't. It sounds like you had amazing family support. You talked about your mum. What was your family setup? Who raised you?
So I mean, even more incredible considering my mum. My mum was a single parent. She raised me in a small council flat in London. I had the incredible fortitude that I lived very close to my mum's parents, my grandma and my granddad. So I was effectively, the three of them effectively co-parented me. Between the four of us, we were kind of like a unit. And I would not be the person I am without them.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you'll instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
It's so beautiful, isn't it? Because you're talking about what acceptance can do for somebody. And
absolutely.
You know, we know this kind of phrase of be kind and love is love. And actually, we don't all have to be the same to get along.
No.
And there's this whole other part to your story around your sexuality.
When you're a child, an autistic child or a child with disabilities, you do find there's a lot of facets of your life that no longer become your own. You sort of almost become part and parcel of the education system, medical professions, teachers, social workers, social carers, all talking about you, about your condition. There's lots of medical appointments you have to do. For me, it was speech and language therapy, like pretty much nonstop up until the age of 8. You suddenly find so many facets of your personality are kind of become part of the sort of public sphere. And I was very much keen on keeping my sexuality as one private element to myself. It was like this little, it was like all my facets of my personality were like a sort of bunch of balloons, and one by one, all these balloons would sort of float away. But I was determined I wanted to keep my gay balloon entirely to myself. And as I sort of became a teenager, it was trying to navigate thinking, what does being an gay man who's autistic mean? Because at that time, I think the best representation of gay life in the UK was Queer as Folk on Channel 4. And I would have been about 13 when it first came on air. And that showed, the very first episode shows a 15-year-old boy going out by himself to Canal Street in Manchester, being picked up by an older man and been taken back to his apartment for sex. And I would be watching this thinking, I couldn't even walk down the road by myself at that point. I would sooner be flying through the air than ever be going out by myself, being engaging with people in a nightclub environment. And I suffer really badly from sensory input. I do not like noisy, overlit, darkened environments. I really do sort of suffer from that. So there is that real sense of, where is my world? Where is life as a gay autist? Where can that be? And that was something that I really did have to sort of navigate. Again, I do think it's getting a lot easier. I'm seeing there's a real network of queer, neurodiverse people online via Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok and other media platforms, which is wonderful. But for me, I was just a few years shy of the digital revolution. So I sort of felt I was an analog boy stepping in into a digital world. But over time, going to university especially, and then going to work, where ironically enough, working, which is the one thing I was very good at, it's where I met my now husband, because he worked at ITV himself.
So I didn't realise that. Like,
yeah,
I wondered
how. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Do you know, it's so funny what you said about the nightclubs, because I had my injuries, I really hate environments like that with loud music, lots of strangers, it's dark. I always think it feels quite unsafe that anyone could tamper with your drink. You know, you just don't know who you're going to meet and what's going to happen. So the one thing I've loved about lockdown is it feels like clubbing has just been deleted from social life.
Oh my God. 100%. 100%.
Yeah. But I love it because I don't like socialising in bars. I don't like socialising in clubs. So now I can just slip under the radar and just, you know.
Honestly, cheers to that. Cheers. I'm drinking chamomile tea at the moment. I'm ready for my cup to you.
I'm drinking chamomile tea. And also,
honestly,
do you know what? I'm so glad. Listeners, we had some technical problems and my camera's broken, so Jack can't see me. And I'm so glad he can't, because I've got a stolen Loose Women mug that I stole.
I think, to be fair, if anyone deserves a Loose Women mug, it's you, Katie. I honestly do. If they haven't given you one already, the fact you've had to steal it is disgraceful, honestly.
So we were talking about Wes. You met Wes at ITV. He's now your husband. Tell us who Wes is. Does Wes have a disability? I don't know a lot about Wes.
No, indeed. No, he's a sort of quiet, elusive person. He's a quite elusive one in our relationship. I think if I'd met someone who was just like me, I think we would have ended up killing each other by now. He's very much my anchor and my rock. So Wes he works at ITV as well, but he is office-based. He works for ITV's sales team. So he's the one who sells all the advertising. Yes, those dull commercials that you have to endure between the shows. They are the ones that pay for our bread and butter. So they are quite important to us. And he was part of a team. In terms of him himself, he has a mild form of cerebral palsy. He was born severely premature. He was 6.5 months when he was born. So he was very small. He was about 2 pounds when he arrived, kicking and screaming into the world. And that obviously had ramifications on his health. He was profoundly deaf up until the age of 4 when he had grommets put in. He had to go through a lot of occupational health. But apart from a mild limp, most people day to day do not know that Wes has cerebral palsy. So again, quite similarly, it is in sort of another person with invisible disability who's sort of raised through the roof. And it wasn't something neither of us discussed for a little while until afterwards. Again, I kind of felt, do I want to disclose the fact that I'm autistic to Wes from the offset? And I made the decision that I wasn't. So it was probably a good few dates before I felt, you know what, I like this guy a lot. I think we need to deal with the elephant in the room. And I said, I have autism. And then it was then that he disclosed the fact that he had cerebral palsy. It's just something we've just kind of together, we've just supported each other with our sort of different needs and wants and on a day-to-day basis. And yeah, it's just like any normal sort of marriage.
It's so fascinating because I have this conversation a lot with other people I work with at my charity, people that have been burnt but acquired the injuries quite recently, people that have burns on their bodies that can be hidden by clothes. And they will say to me, when I date someone, when should I disclose it? Should it be on the first coffee? Should it be later down the line when I think intimacy is going to be a thing? And I suppose for me, I've never had that in dating for two reasons. You know, one, it's on my face. People see it straight away. And two, I've chosen to be in the public eye. So my story's already out there. And it's interesting hearing you talk about your career and your love life that you didn't disclose straight away. What's no. your opinion and what's your advice for anybody with something they need to disclose at some point? When is wrong, when is right, and why did you decide to take the journey you did with the disclosure?
You know, with rose-tinted spectacles, I say, yes, it's 2021. We're beyond this now. We should all be free to disclose and be open to who we are. And I do sincerely hope and envisage that in soon that won't be an issue at all. But there is still that sense of you still need to be aware and you still need to be confident and you need to kind of have that in, so to speak. You need to kind of be in that environment first to just see how you feel. Because also you don't know how you're going to respond or react personally until you're in the environment yourself. I want everybody to succeed because of their workplace environment and not in spite of it. And that is something that is improving. But again, you know, time is a factor and it's just a case of education, 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 and having opportunities like this to discuss it.
Do you know, it's so funny when you were talking about environments and feeling comfortable, it just reminded me of a memory. I mean, I've been with my husband now for 10 years, but it reminded me of when I was dating before I met him. And when people would ask me to go for a drink or lunch or dinner, whatever it was, I would try and find out the venue first, and I would go and do a recce a week ahead of the venue to see if it was the right environment for me to go. Would it be violent or intimidating? Is it a rough crowd? Is the lighting really bright? Am I going to feel uncomfortable? Is it by an open door where people might suddenly be rushing in and out that would make me jumpy? Not tell the person I was dating that I did that. Turn up a week later for the date pretending I'd never been to the location.
Oh my goodness, Katie, you're pretty much me. This is basically my life. I am the world's most hyper, especially now in an age of Google Maps. I can basically plot my entire thing from the journey to, I mean, with the internet, pictures, everything. Everything I do is preempted to within an inch of its life. And I find that's just the way I can function. And honestly, I think there's nothing wrong with having a recce in advance. I would actively encourage it.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, like, for me, I don't regret it, because one of my biggest problems back then was my eyes. You know, I had a lot of problems with my cornea. My eyes can't adjust to light. So if something was too bright, I wouldn't be able to look at someone in the eye. Then yeah. I'd just become a bit socially awkward, not being able to make eye contact. And, you know, and then I had problems with my esophagus, which meant I needed to sit near a toilet if I was eating. So there were all these things that, had I not done all that prep, I would have just come across as really kind of antsy and uncomfortable, and that wasn't really me. So it helped, you know.
I bet it did. No, and it is so true. And my biggest, I'm a man with very few regrets in my life, but I think too often when I was younger, as a young adult, I put myself in situations that I was uncomfortable with because I felt that was the sort of thing I needed to do as a young adult, to socialize, to go to places that I was not overly familiar with, overly comfortable with. And invariably, all it led was just to me to be, as you said, socially awkward, to be so socially awkward, to be so uncomfortable. It wasn't an enjoyable experience for me, and it wasn't an enjoyable experience for those around me. And as I've gotten older, I'm very much aware of my likes and my dislikes now, and I don't put myself in situations now where I know that I'm just going to be uncomfortable. Life's too short now to make myself feel so miserable and so anxious.
See, that for me, I mean, that's a very empowering statement. And I do believe that is actually true confidence. Like, you're not doing things to be a people pleaser. You're not doing things because it's the right thing to do to fit in. You're doing what's good for you. And that is somebody that's genuinely confident, I think.
Thank you. No, thank you. It took a long time. I will say that this is only something that I've really sort of come into in the last few years, I say like 3 or 4 years of my life. And That is something I will say to anybody younger than I am. Don't ever feel pressured into doing something you do not want to do, especially in the workplace environment. And especially when you're younger, there is that expectation. But expectation is just a pathway to sadness, in my experience. And I think it's just something that it is tough to be that person that says, no, I'm not comfortable with this. And you kind of would like to believe that you're the people that you work with and people who surround with would be understanding and appreciative of that. And that is key, I think. It is actually reframing the discussions about disability as a whole. It's not about what it's not about what you want the disabled person to do for you. It's actually what you can do for the disabled person.
Yeah, that's such a powerful conversation, and perhaps one that hasn't really been had enough. So another journey and other steps that you are starting is you and Wes are adopting a child.
Yes, indeed. And we have actually just very recently, we have, it's all been signed. It's happened. We have actually formally adopted now. We have our boy now, which is incredible. It has been an experience, and it's just incredible to say, especially as someone who did not have a father whilst growing up, to say that I am a father. It's still a wonderful experience. And still every day he is truly the light of my life.
And you've been really good you've set up a podcast together.
Yeah.
And actually the podcast is called Two Dads Can Do It.
Yes, indeed.
And I had a listen, and do you know what? It's very informative because...
thank you.
Yeah, it's not just for people who are autistic or gay. It could be for single adopters, heterosexual couples.
Absolutely.
You know, I actually think it just takes the mystery out of the whole process.
There are a lot of people in this country who don't quite understand what adoption process is, how involved it is, the sort of things you sort of have to do, and how long or how short it can be. It is quite a long, involved emotional process. So I think when we set up the podcast as well as our Instagram account, it was to underpin the mystery, really, and just to kind of be as transparent as we could be and to show, actually, you know what? It is something that can be done.
Mm. See, I think it's brilliant with the podcast and with the Instagram. You're raising awareness. You're sort of helping other people along their journey. But you are vulnerable. You know, we've talked about all these differences, you know, sexuality, disability, two men adopting a child. There are lots of vulnerabilities that other people with more archaic opinions could troll you for, could give you a backlash, you know.
Yeah.
Talk about that, putting yourself out there like that. That's scary.
Everything I do on Instagram, I do for nobody else but for my younger self. I like to imagine what I would have been like as a 13-year-old boy, autistic, hadn't disclosed his sexuality to everybody, was very unsure what his world would be like. And what would I want to see? What would I want? And it is about seeing just people living their life. And disability is something that you can take ownership of. It's not something that you should be hiding from. It's not something that, if there's issues with your disability, it is society's problem, not yours. It's about not allowing yourself to be undermined or constrained by the people around you. It is about living your life as authentically as you can.
This exactly what you're saying. This is what attracts me to you. This is why I thought you've got to come on the podcast. I hope he agrees. Because I just feel like there's something in you, like it's some kind of strength, it's some kind of resilience where, you know, you have had a lot of odds stacked against you, but you've been victorious despite that. Where does this come from?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you are incredibly kind. I think I am, as I've often said, that I am merely the clay, and I've been modelled by the people around me. I have a very close group of friends who I deeply love, who understand me, who get me. And that sense of getting a person is not something that I you always have as an autistic person. So I'm incredibly lucky to have had that. I was very lucky at the age of 19 to have stepped into a workplace environment that felt right for me. I was incredibly fortunate to have had a supportive network of colleagues who allowed me to flourish and allowed me to grow. And, you know, autism is something that I was born with. It is something I will die with. It is part of me. It's part of the warp and weft of my life. It has informed every facet of my life. But it is just saying that and taking ownership of that and basically reaching a point in your life and saying, this is who I am. This is what I am. You just have to try and accept it. It's society that needs to accept it and just carry on and live your best life. And if that life is for people who may not be able to ever be employed or aren't able to live independently, that's not an issue either. It is about what makes you happy rather than what is making the outside world and society happy. And I think that is something that is just needs to be reiterated and shouted from the rooftops of everybody with disabilities. It is about what works for you, not for everybody else.
I think that's just such a brilliant closing statement because
thank you.
Yeah, and I want to thank you actually because you're being so transparent and you're being, you know, so public in such an educational way that you are helping so many young Jacks. And not just young Jacks, you're helping parents and friends and family members of young Jacks as well. So I really want to thank you for that.
I am a product of the people I work with, including people like yourself, Katie. You do make my job very, very easy. Not everyone does, but you are one that does. And for that, I am extremely grateful.
You do the same for me. You're so good at your job. So you've been a big support for me in any time I've worked with ITV. So thank you. And, you know, anyone that's listening that wants to know more about Jack and Wes's journey, please do look up his podcast. It's called Two Dads Can Do It. And, my doorbell's just rang. That's the Amazon guy.
On that note.
Oh, dear. You have been absolutely extraordinary. As the podcast suggests, extraordinary people. Jack, thank you so much.
Katie, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much indeed.
Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please follow where you get your podcasts. Also, if you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show or share on your socials.